Hi, my name is Dory. I'm an alcoholic, and I've had a very crazy week with lots going on, and then I just got asked to speak. So, my sobriety date is April 15th, 2003, and I haven't found a pickup since that date. I've been blessed with only one sobriety date, and I owe that to the fact that I was blessed with something called the gift of desperation. Which is that I was so desperate to get sober. I had been begging, begging, begging God to help me get sober. And so once I finally got sober, I haven't wanted to give it up. I grew up in Connecticut, my dad worked for IBM. We had like a big, nice home, but I always grew up feeling uncomfortable in my own skin. I was like a ha glass half empty type of girl. And actually, when I worked in treatment, one of my clients raised her hand and said, "My glass had a hole in it." I said, "That's probably even closer to me." I grew up kind of always noticing what was wrong for some reason. My mom had, my parents did not drink, but my mother was the adult child of an alcoholic. And her parents committed suicide before I was born. So she grew up in a very, very dysfunctional home, and she tried to be a good mom, but she kind of lacked in the nurturing department. And I think because she'd lived in fear for so long, I grew up thinking we were having a lot of financial problems, and looking back, we were quite comfortable, but I never realized it. I always felt fearful. I remember going to preschool. And I guess I was about 4 or 5, and I came in for the first time, and I looked around the room, and I'm like, they're all friends with each other, and they're not going to like me. So, I mean, if that's not alcoholic thinking, I don't know what else is, right? But I was very, very shy and very quiet. I was the middle child. My older sister became very rebellious in junior high and high school, and I have a younger brother who is labeled. He was labeled brain damaged and ADHD and mentally retarded, and he had lots of issues. And I was kind of the quiet, good child. So I was kind of ignored a lot just because I wasn't acting out. And I was the one who was following, the family rules. So I did not try alcohol until I was a senior in high school. And I was over one of my friend's house, and she gave me a beer, and I didn't want to act like I've never had one before, so I took a taste. I've never liked the taste of beer, and but I drank a little bit, and then I remember I'm like, I told her, I said, "I feel funny." And she's like, "Have you ever drank before?" And I'm like, "No." And it was not love at first sight. I've heard many people say, "Oh, they had the first drink," and no, that was not it for me. Back then, at 18 in Connecticut, it was legal to drink. So when I turned 18, a good friend of mine, we had dated some, he took me to a bar and grill, and I had something that was much tastier, and I had a couple drinks. But again, I was like, "Oh, this is nice." Didn't really fall in love with it, and I didn't have anything until the very end of my senior year. I had an aunt who'd passed away from cancer, and it was a real tragic story. One of her daughters was driving her to the hospital, and my aunt stopped breathing, and my cousin tried to give her mouth to mouth and couldn't revive her. And I was so upset. I was really devastated over it. I'd never been taught how to handle my emotions, and I had never been encouraged to share them. I'd actually been told that children should be seen and not heard. So I held everything in, which is not healthy at all. And my parents ended up going to the funeral with my sister and my brother, but I had a bunch of tests because it was my to graduate, so I didn't go. And I ended up going to a party, and I got very, very drunk, and I got sick. And I think somewhere in the back of my mind, something was like, "Ah, this is a great way to deal with those emotions." Because I'd never known how to deal with them at all, except for just to suppress them. So I went off to college. I made sure I was far away from my mom because we'd never really bonded very well. And my freshman year in college, I found out that my dad had a brain tumor. And he was my favorite person in the entire world. And it was my, he's gonna die, he's not gonna die, he has a brain tumor, he's not gonna have a brain tumor. And it was very, very hard to deal with for me, especially so that I really had no coping skills at all. And I'd grown up in a Christian home and I prayed, but I'd never really learned how to internalize everything and just how to meditate. I would pray and ask God for things, but I'd never really been taught to seek out His will, just to try to. I was always told, just do the next right thing. Anyways, I went to a Christian college where you were not allowed to drink or smoke on campus, which is probably the only reason I actually graduated. Back then, we would go Wednesday nights. It was disco time. Some of you might be old enough to remember the disco days. I'm 67, so but back then, so and they being 18 though in Ohio, you can only get something called 3-2 beer, which is like tastes still as bad but has less alcohol. So it was like, why would I want that? Because I never drink for the taste. But whenever my friends and I could get something from a liquor store, if we had a chance, we would drink something, but it wasn't very often. My father passed away my sophomore year. And I remember getting very, very drunk after that. And it was very, very painful to deal with. I really did not know how to deal with emotions and losing my favorite person in the entire world. And so I struggled through college, just having a hard time, being depressed, having a lot of anxiety. My mom wanted me to drop out of college and come home and take care of her and her emotional needs. And I was like, no, like, I can't even take care of mine. I can't help you with yours. So I did eventually graduate from college, and my mom had moved down to Florida after about 2 years after my dad had passed away. She moved to Florida, and I was going to college in Ohio, and I eventually, after college, I came down to Florida. And eventually I got my own apartment, and then that was nice because I was drinking little wine coolers. And there was nobody to give me any accountability. And I would drink maybe a couple. And slowly over time, I drank more and more. And I knew my grandparents were alcoholics, and I knew I had an aunt. My aunt Anne was an alcoholic, but it wasn't talked about back then that because it runs in your family that you could become an alcoholic easier. So, and since I'd never seen anybody drink in my home, it never dawned on me that this could be a problem. So over time, I ended up meeting my husband at church. He had this beautiful voice. I saw lots of red flags, but I was a behavior analyst at the time, so I was sure I'd be able to fix all his problems, which doesn't work at all. It not at all. So we were happy until we had children, and then my husband became kind of jealous that they were getting more attention. Over time, our relationship started going downhill. And I ended up getting better jobs over time. We were struggling financially, and he ended up getting worse jobs, and he started mentally declining. And every red flag that I'd seen that I ignored turned out to be accurate. So I dealt with it by drinking more and more, because that seemed to be the only way I knew how. And I had some trauma that happened. I worked with special needs adults for a while, and one of them passed away during the daytime. And I thought we accidentally killed him, but it had nothing to do with us. And then I was working with autistic preschoolers, and one of them passed away during nap time, and we tried to revive her, and it was just a horrific incident. And so those two incidents, that was the marital problems, everything kind of combined. It was like the perfect storm to turn into a full-blown alcoholic. And I kept drinking and drinking, and I knew it was a problem. And I knew somebody, I was a behavior analyst, and I had one of my clients' dads went to AA, and I didn't really understand the anonymous thing. So I thought, well, if I go to AA, he's gonna see me there and he'll tell everybody. So I didn't go, and eventually I ended up losing all my clients when I was a behavior analyst, and I got a job at a school. And I was employed for 2 weeks, and I only showed up 3 times. And for some reason, they said they didn't want me to come back again. And then we were getting all these notices, and I was hiding them from my husband because he thought I was somehow paying all the bills. And eventually they came and took my car. They repossessed my car in the middle of the night. So at that point, my husband was, and I'd always been the one who'd always had to take care of the financial responsibilities and pay everything. And so now my husband's like, "Oh, you know, I guess you haven't been paying the rent either." And I'm like, "I've been home drunk. How did you think I was gonna pay it?" So he went down. He did something called, he got me marchman enacted. So this was definitely an act of God. I had gotten so sick, I was down to 95 pounds, which is not an attractive weight. And I was like throwing up bile and I was having diarrhea. I was like really, really sick. And he went down to the courthouse and filled out all the paperwork to have me marchman enacted, which is like I'm being hospitalized because of my drinking. So some very nice policemen came and picked me up one morning and they took me to a hospital. And they drew my blood. And then that somebody came in and they're like, "You have a really high alcohol content." And I'm like, "Well, it's 10 a.m. "Yes, of course I do." And they sent me to another hospital and I was on the psych ward for 2 weeks. And I was, you know, most people when they get in the back of a police car, they're not happy. I knew that when those men had put me in that police car that God had saved my life. Because I knew that if I hadn't stopped drinking and I physically could not stop on my own, I think I was having seizures. I knew that God had saved my life. And so when I was in the hospital detoxing, my husband came and visited me and told me he was gonna get custody of the children and divorce me and I'd never see them again, which really wasn't very helpful at the time. And so after I got done the 2 weeks, they sent me over to another place to figure out what kind of treatment I was going to do. And they wanted me to do residential, but they didn't have any openings. So I ended up doing outpatient and I had no car. So for 6 months, I took two buses to treatment and two buses home in South Florida, which is really not very fun. There's the kind of, a lot of the people that are on the bus are not allowed to drive because of their behavior, and a lot of them were under the influence. So for 2 months, I went 5 days a week, and then for 2 months, I went twice a week at night, and then for 2 months, I went once a week at night. And one of my friends from AA went from treatment invited me to go AA, and I was like, "Well, I'm doing pretty good," because I'd started going back to church, and somebody from church invited me to a Christian 12-step, and I was doing all that. She's like, "Dory, you really don't have a social life. You don't really have a lot of friends." And I'm like, "Well, that's true." So I'm like, "Okay." So then I went to an AA meeting with her, and I was like, "Oh, I really like this." She said, "It's just like church," but it wasn't really just like church, but I really liked it. And I felt like it was really good for me to do. So I started going to as many AA meetings as I could get to. So as I started doing less and less treatment, I just went to more and more meetings. So a lot of days I was going, you know, up to three meetings a day and taking buses all over town. And I got a sponsor and I worked the steps. You know, and they took all the suggestions. And, you know, at first they're like, "Well, you should get on your knees." And I thought getting on your knees was a metaphor for praying. I'm like, "Oh, you mean you really get on your knees?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't really need to get on my knees to pray." And then I'm like, "Well, I was getting on my knees to throw up. So, you know, it's better to get on my knees to pray." So I did everything they told me to do. And slowly, 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 my life got better. Very slowly, not as fast as I would have liked it. And people would go, I've heard people say, "Oh, I wish it was slow recovery." And I understand that now. I worked in treatment for 17 years. And what I've seen happen is when people, everything, you know, gets great right away, the disease is like, "Oh, that wasn't so bad. I could do it again." And that was not what happened with me. Things like taking the bus to, you know, to treatment and everywhere and looking for jobs, taking a bus. And, having to pee in front of a cop, but you know, when I was in treatment and I'm like, "Go to shut the door," and she's like, "I need to watch the stream coming out of you." And I was like totally appalled. I'm like, this is another reason to stay sober. Every miserable thing that I didn't like in early recovery, I'm like, this is another reason to stay sober because I might have to go through this again and it would be worse. And I just did that. And one of the things I heard that really helped me, I heard a man at a meeting and he shared he'd been to jail about 50 times. And he said he never romances what a drink would feel like. And that instead he plays out the tape. And that's one of the things that has really helped. I never look at a drink and think, oh, wouldn't that feel, you know, I don't. I play out the tape and I remember what would happen. I remember I'm in the bathroom, on my knees, throwing up bile. And I'm in the bedroom shaking, and my older daughter came in and she's like checking on me to, I think, to make sure I was still alive. And I remember saying, "Mommy, I don't want you to die." And then I would picture my kids at my funeral. And it's like a sunny day, and there's a tree, and the sun, and the grass, and a big hole, and a casket, and my kids dressed in black. And every time that I was, not that I wanted to drink, but I wanted to relieve the way that I felt, I would think of that. And it's like, that's just not going to be an option for me, no matter what. You know, I've heard of some people that they're in the no matter what club. I'm in the no matter what club. It's like, there's nothing, no problem that I have that a drink cannot make worse. It will not improve any of them. After a couple of years, well, when I had a couple of years sober, I got fired for something that happened on my day off. And I didn't, you know, it was very frustrating. And I ended up getting a better job closer to home with better hours and better salary. And after a while, I think I had about 5 or 6 years sober. My husband and I had been separated and he passed away. And that was like his brother's posting 5 minutes after I found out he passed away, his brother's posting out on Facebook. I'm like, the kids don't know their dad is dead yet. Can you please take that off of Facebook? And I had to tell them. And we put together a lovely memorial service for him. And 6 months later, my mother passed away. I've had like lots of things happen, but there's nothing that's happened that having a drink would make better. Nothing. And some of the things that I've learned is, you know, the acceptance, saying acceptance when I'm in a frustrating situation. I've had some frustrating situations at work. One of the ladies I work now, it's a special ed teacher again, and one of the ladies in charge of a lot of things left suddenly. And they end up putting somebody in charge who doesn't really know how to do her job and is left to like a lot of chaos and everything. And then sometimes I'm like, an acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. Or I'll say the serenity prayer. I learned to pray and meditate. Guided meditations are very helpful for me. There's like a great app called Insight Timer. But I went to lots of meditation meetings when I, especially in early recovery, because I didn't know how to calm that feeling. Exercise is something that's helped me. Taking a warm bath will help me. Going on YouTube and typing in AA funny speaker. When I start laughing, I feel better. Taking a walk. And also in early recovery, people told me to great be grateful. And I'm like, I'm taking the bus. What do I have to be grateful for? Let me see. I drove in a black on New Year's Eve and forgot one of my kids in
Two
the
minutes.
car.
Two minutes.
Nothing happened to her. You know, we got home safely. I never got a DUI. My children were never taken away from me. I was never homeless. There are so many worse consequences that I could have had that I never had. And I've just learned to, there's like, I have a big support group. I go to a lot of meetings. I chair meetings. I have to, I keep, I do a, on Saturday, do what I do an in-person meeting. When I got sober, there was no Zoom. And all the meetings were in person. And I used to go to the meeting before the meeting where we'd socialize, and then after the meeting, where we would go out to eat. And I don't do that as often, but I still, on Saturday, I get to see my sponsor and one of my sponsees. And I love that support, that connection really helps. You know, and I do a lot of things in the morning. I read my daily reflection, I read a religious reading, I pray, I meditate. Every day I put God in charge of my day. I read this man, they asked, he interviewed a lot of people that relapsed. He's like, did you sincerely pray for help? And they all said no, except for one who said, well, I prayed I wouldn't get hurt too badly. So it's very, very important that I put God in charge of my day. Do all of that. That's like putting on my armor for the day, right? If I'm in charge of my day, I know what'll happen. I could drink, I could die, I can make bad choices. So it's always very important that that's what I do. I'm just about out of time, and that's all I got. Thank you.